This is an ABC podcast.
In the middle of our life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood where the direct way was lost. That's the beginning of Dante's great epic poem, The Divine Comedy. Dante was writing in the 14th century, but his sense of being lost in life's journey echoes the experience of my guest today, Hilary McPhee. Hilary has had a distinguished career as a writer, editor and publisher. Along with her late friend, Diana Gribble, she founded McPhee Gribble, which published writers who were at the time unknown, including Helen Garner and Tim Winton. Then, a few years ago, when Hilary was in her mid-60s, with grown-up children and a long marriage to an interesting man, things started to unravel at home. Out of the blue, she received a curious job offer from a prince in Jordan. In saying yes to that adventure, Hilary also ended up saying yes to living alone in a village in Tuscany, which was not at all how she expected it to be. Hilary's new memoir is called Other People's Houses. Hi, Hilary. Welcome to Conversations.
Thanks, Sarah.
When did you first travel to the Middle East, Hilary?
Actually, a million years ago, when I was first married and I went on a cargo boat. Those were the days when you could hop on a cargo boat and there were no other passengers.
What was on your cargo boat?
It was taking cars and live sheep to the Middle East when the Middle Eastern countries were quite small. Kuwait was tiny. I do remember very vividly arriving in Kuwait. We hired a cab which had a record player in the car with 45s being played as we bounced along on these very bumpy streets. Incredibly hot if you were bumping along in a Cadillac. There were Cadillacs in the, through the desert. My husband was able to go right into the desert, but because I was a woman, I was expected to stay on the boat with the captain's wife, and that was irritating, but we did get ashore in the major ports.
Well, a few lifetimes after being on that boat, you were living in Melbourne and were contacted by a woman you'd last seen as a teenager. How had you two known each other?
I had no idea who this woman was. She gave me her name and waited for me to recognise it, and I didn't. But then when I met her, I arranged to meet her in March. She said we'd been at school together. I'd had a year at Colac High School, and that's where we'd met, and we'd been in the same hockey team.
What was the name of your hockey team?
The hockey team was the Colac Battlers, which was a fabulous name for a hockey team. And as soon as I saw her sitting in Murray's, I recognised her, and she started telling me about her life, which had been spent the last 10 or 15 years in the Middle East. She'd been working for a prince in Amman. And we had a strange kind of conversation, swapped notes about husbands and children and all the things that had happened to us in the probably 40 years since I'd seen her before. But she said in a rather mysterious voice, "You may get to hear something from the palace." And I thought, what? And she said mysteriously, "I can't tell you more, but you may hear something."
Did it feel like she was making you a job offer?
No, she wasn't. She definitely wasn't making me a job offer, because she was so definite about the offer coming from her boss, who was, she said, called Sidi Hassan. "You may hear from Sidi Hassan's manager, or someone in the palace may get in touch." It was a very mysterious, something that just does not happen to you if you live in Fitzroy and are just wandering along one day and you have this strange thing. So I forgot about it, and life went on for me. I let her know, this woman know, that I was going to be in London just in case. And then the next phone call was from someone in London, from the office of His Royal Highness in Jordan. And they were just as mysterious too, and didn't give me any details.
What did they say to you?
Just said, "We would like to suggest that you come to Amman and talk about a project." A writing project was how it was described.
What did you know about Amman or Jordan? I mean, what did you know about the modern country?
I knew, by this time, when they started bringing me in London, I went to the British Library and looked it up, because I knew very little. And I knew if they did manage to get me to Amman, I thought, oh, great, on my way home, I'll pop in and see what this is all about. So I looked them up in the British Library and discovered that I knew a bit more about this royal family than I realised, because King Hussein of Jordan was a very famous character. He had four wives. He was very glamorous. He flew aeroplanes. And he was a playboy, and Western magazines adored him and adored his wives, and they were always very beautiful and always very photographed. So I had that to go on, and I looked that up in the British Library and discovered that the big story was that he had died a few years before, and the succession was thought by everybody to be going to his younger brother, Prince Hassan. And Hassan is, of course, the Sidi Hassan that I've been told about back in Melbourne. But on his deathbed, King Hussein gave the succession to his son, and his son is now the present king. And of course, that must have been a shattering event. And the press were absolutely agog with this drama. In the British Library, there are all kinds of magazine articles about it and so on. But all of them said they admired Prince Hassan very much because he'd given no interviews. He maintained a very dignified silence, and other people gossiped about it. So I thought this was rather impressive. I looked that up, so I knew a bit about that, and I then started checking out the state of Jordan and what how big it was and so on. And
how big is it?
It's only about the size of Tasmania. It's not very big at all, but there are lots of people there, and refugees pour in every time there's a war. And during the Iraq War, there were 750,000 Iraqis that poured in. And now Syrians, of course, and it's just been, and the Palestinians have been pouring in across the border since 1948. So it's a country that manages refugees, and that has a royal family that was installed when Transjordan was created by Churchill way back. So it's an odd little place with odd boundaries, but bounded by Iraq, bounded by Syria, bounded by Saudi Arabia, bounded by Israel. So it's a country that I've then started finding quite interesting.
So there you are in the British Library, reading up about this royal family, finding out details about this country the size of Tasmania, right in the heart of the Middle East. What happened next? When did you get the tickets?
They kept ringing me, saying the tickets are on their way. I was about to go home, and I kept getting messages to say that the tickets will be there. The tickets never arrived. I finally got so crabby that I left London without the tickets and without telling them where I was going. But somehow they found me in Vienna. So I got as far as Vienna, and the tickets arrived. I got a phone call in the middle of the night from the desk of the hotel we were in, saying, there's an email from Jordan, and they read it to me, saying if you present yourself to the Royal Jordanian Airways, they will give you first-class tickets to Amman. So down I went in the morning and got the tickets, and off I went. This is just before Christmas in 2005.
Yes. Did you have any idea what to expect, Hillary?
No, but I was determined to go and find out by this stage. I was thoroughly tantalised, and I'd read lots of stuff in the British Library, and my eyes were sticking out on stalks, so I really wanted to go, but I was very pissed off with the way the whole thing was taking forever.
How were you treated at the airport? What was the experience of flying first class
at the airport? I was ushered into something called Crown Class, which I'd never been anything called Crown Class before, C-R-O-W-N-E, and it was very posh, with blue, rather smoke-filled, because everybody smokes, smoke-filled blue couches with cushions, and offered all kinds of teas and very fine little bits to eat and so on.
Did you need a special passport or visa?
No visa at all. I was being brought in. Crown Class means that you're brought in, I suppose, like diplomats. It just means that you're brought in under the aegis of the Crown, and you're the guest of the royal household. That's what it technically means. So in I went as a guest of a royal household and was driven in a car to the hotel, where I was searched because they just had the first suicide bombing in Jordan only a few weeks before, and everybody was utterly shattered, of course. So I was searched every time I went in. It was a very nervous place. But I was in a rather posh hotel with a very large suite, much bigger than my house. It was enormous, with a spa bath and all that stuff. And I was met there by a charming young woman who was the research assistant of Prince Hassan. So I felt rather relieved when I met her. She was lovely, and she was going to pick me up in the afternoon and take me. And she couldn't answer any questions. She said, leave it, you'll find out more when you get there. So I went and had a spa bath, I think, and certainly a rest, and was picked up in the afternoon when I was taken off to the palace.
Taken off to the palace. Mm. Who was there to meet you?
We were taken to a guest house in the grounds, which is a very beautiful little building. It was winter, December. It was very, very cold. So there were open fires burning and lovely gleaming parquet floors with mats, and it was lovely. It was absolutely beautiful. And first of all, I was met by the prince's daughter, Princess Badia, who I think was checking me out to make sure I was suitable to introduce her to her family. And then her mother breezed in, who was gorgeous, marvellous Pakistani Siti Sabat, I've got used to calling. She said, "Now you must ask my husband anything you like. He has to do this book. He must do it." Clearly, she wanted the story, and I suspect he didn't. Well, so,
what impression did he first make on you?
He sidled into the room after a bit when his wife was still there, and he was quite a short man, grey hair, grey suit, very dignified but very depressed. I could tell he was miserable. He walked in a miserable fashion and just stood there rather miserably, and his wife introduced him to me, and she then whizzed away, saying, "Ask him anything you like," and off she went, and off the daughter went, just leaving me and Prince Hassan. And we had a perfectly fine conversation, but he didn't ask me any questions at all about me. I just popped up as this person that was going to help him with a book.
Could he talk to you then about what sort of book he might want you to work with him on?
The conversation with his wife and daughter was about an autobiography, and they wanted help from me to help him write his autobiography, which is a very peculiar request. That was what I kind of tried to quiz him about, just to get a sense of how prepared he was to spill the beans, to spill some beans. I mean, I didn't particularly want to go into all the shock horror stuff like a women's magazine had already done in London. But because they had already said he maintained a dignified silence in the face of the catastrophe, as it was to him and the
when
family,
he wasn't appointed
when
the
he
king.
Didn't become king, that wasn't the story. I wanted the story of his being crown prince there. He'd been crown prince for 30 years. He'd been, when he was a very young man, I think 18, I think, and just going up to Oxford. He was educated in England. The war broke out and he was whisked home so his brother could be in charge of the army and Sidi Hassan could start doing the work of a crown prince, running the affairs at home. He'd been certainly, as crown prince, in charge of building very important institutions in Jordan. They have very interesting educational institutions and women have been educated for a long time, things like that. So I knew enough of the basics to, well, not making a complete fool of myself, basically, but to ask the questions that would tease out what kind of book.
And what do you think he was making of you, Hillary?
No idea. Obviously, I would have been vetted. There was no way I was just going to be flown in because someone in London sent me some tickets. I was going to be vetted. And I would have been vetted in probably out of Canberra. I don't know how these things work. But he didn't ask me any questions. He name-dropped a bit. He said, "Gareth Evans comes here sometimes and Peter Singer comes here sometimes." And they were men I'd met. And he said he'd been to Australia on his honeymoon, which was in the early 70s during Whitlam's era, and he'd ridden. He was a horseman and a very good polo player. I knew that. And he'd ridden the horses around the tan, and he said they were very frisky police horses, but, you know, I managed. He was a bit boastful about physical stuff. So we had that kind of conversation, but no questions of me.
How did you and Prince Hassan find yourselves in a car together the next
because
day?
Because I was sent away after this first meeting with 100 pages to read. So back I went to the hotel with 100 pages and I read them overnight and then returned the next day with my opinion of them. And that opinion was delivered in his very formal office where he looked like a prime minister rather than a king. I was relieved to see, because prime ministers are fairly familiar things, but I don't know about kings and princes at all. I didn't know a thing.
He wasn't wearing a crown.
He wasn't wearing a crown. He was in a business suit. He had a Mont Blanc pen like they all do and a flag behind his desk and lots of photos. And we just sat at a very informal sort of coffee table and so on. He wanted to know what I'd made of, I think he called it his ditty or his wife called it his ditty. One of them did.
Which
meant that I know how it would have been called his ditty. Oh, he's going off in the morning to record his ditty. So the what I had were transcripts of interviews that someone had done in the past that I'd never even really discovered. I think several people had been involved in transcribing things. So they weren't very good, but they had some fabulous material. So when I returned the next morning, I said, the bits I'm really interested in are about your childhood, about the crown, being crown prince, about the wars, about how you managed to build various things in Jordan. And I was very enthusiastic because, indeed, I was very much wanting to do this project, providing the backup was going to be there. And that was what was not discussed at that meeting either, but was vaguely discussed when I went and had lunch with
so
the family.
So how do you end up in the car together from this point?
We went off in the car together. After lunch, I was asked if I'd like a tour, and of course I jumped at it. And because it was clear I was going to be shown the places that were most important to Prince Hassan, and off he went off to get warm coats, and I was handed a burqa to put on later, and we hopped into out the front of the family palace, which was a very beautiful house, had pulled up this enormous motorcade with a huge, I don't know the names of these cars, but an enormous army jeep, vast, with guns on the back. And Prince Hassan was driving it, and he said to me, hop up next to him so that he could show me the places as we drove through the streets.
And so you drove off at the front of that motorcade?
In the front of a motorcade. There were several cars behind, but as we drove out of the palace, many, many more. They do motorcades in Jordan all the time, very long motorcades. So there were lots of cars, jeeps pulling up behind with guns. So off we went, and I kept thinking, I can hardly believe this is happening, but it was thrilling. And Prince Hassan kept driving into, he said, I hate these motorcades, he said to me. I hate them, but they insist, they being the king, present king, they insist I have them. So he kept ducking up roads that the motorcade couldn't go in to show me bits where there were stairs going up where his mother used to come down to buy bread from the baker. And we went into all kinds. The motorcade found us the minute we appeared into streets that were wide enough for these vehicles to go down.
What sort of stories did he tell you about his childhood on that trip?
He told me stories as we went along, which were about where he was born. His mother had a midwife. The hospital hadn't been built by then. So he had interesting stuff to say about midwives. He said the midwife came to my mother and they were friends, and she, you know, stuff that really made me prick up my ears. And he showed me the coffee shop he used to go to as a child, places where people brought things. And people knocked on the window of the car as we were going up these narrow streets and waved at him, and he would wind down the window or press a button, down it would go, and he would know them by name. And it was he was giving me a glimpse of a man who was very at ease in a small Amman, and the part we were in was old downtown, which is the small part. The rest of Amman is now enormous with hideous kind of buildings and shopping centres going out for miles. So,
and were people wanting just to say hello, or were they making requests?
They wanted to say hello, and he knew them and asked them how their families were, all of that. They obviously loved him. So he was giving me a tour of people loving him as well, which was very heartwarming and splendid.
What about that tradition of petitioning that happens in parts of the Middle East,
yes,
where you go to the powerful person in your village?
That's the downside of being a child at school in Amman. A prince, he was at the local school in Amman before he was sent off, poor thing, to Harrow. But when he was a little boy, he'd have his school bag stuffed with petitions from people wanting them to go back to his family. And they were things like, you know, my child can't get the education he wants, or we've had an accident, or someone's been killed and we need money or something. So the petitions were a problem and remain a problem. That is how that world tends to work.
Where did you end up on that day around old Amman?
We went to see his sports centre, the new sports centre in Amman, which indeed is hugely impressive, where, to my astonishment, he said, I'm now going to have a player game of squash. And there was some kind of festival of young people on at the sports centre that had been bussed in from all over the Middle East to play squash. And Prince Hassan arrives and announces that he's going to play a game of squash. And the best person, presumably, was chosen to play him at squash. And indeed, he's a brilliant squash player. And the sportsmaster kept saying to me, he's not only a brilliant squash player, he's a black belt in judo and he's this and that and an amazing polo player and all of those things. So sport was a very big factor. So I sat there and I was introduced to his cardiologist and his sports centre manager and his publicist. And then we all bundled into the car and went down to have coffee in an old friend's place in Amman near where he'd been born as a child. So it was an amazing day. I was just stunned. I couldn't understand most of the conversations, of course, but every now and then they'd translate something fabulous for me and I fell for it, hook, line and sinker.
What were you falling for?
I was falling for the sense that there was a really terrific story that needed to be told. He hadn't told it. Also, I was fascinated by the city and the way the city was growing, the fact that, of course, that the war was just over the border and how they were coping. And we talked about those things in, you know, very rushed terms. But I was completely smitten by this project. So back I go to the hotel and start packing and emailing my family that I must do it. Then the phone rings and the receptionist, and it was in a very excited voice, said, "I want to put through Prince Hassan from the palace." So on he came onto the line and said, had I had a good day and was I interested in proceeding with this project? And I said, yes, indeed I am. And I will come back in April and we'll start it then. I will work out how to do it when I'm in Australia. So that was it. So I flew back to Australia feeling this was the most marvellous thing, not having worked up money or any sort of resources for the project. But
yes to the adventure.
Yes to the thing.
Hilary, as this new exciting adventure is opening up for you in Jordan, what was happening with your life back home in Australia?
My life back home in Australia had absolutely fallen in a heap. I came back from the Jordan seduction and my husband of 20 years announced that he wanted to keep moving. He'd been in America writing a book and he wanted to. So I was completely shattered by this, of
course.
Keep
moving. What does that mean?
Meaning that he was going back to America. I knew he was to finish working, but that he wanted to end the marriage. And that was a gobsmacking event. But I didn't want to argue about it. I decided if he was prepared to say something like that after a long time together, I wasn't prepared to argue and I was just going to keep moving, basically. And because this project had been offered me in Jordan, I was going to go back there in April, I then texted my friends and said, this is what we're going to do. We're splitting up and I'm going back to Jordan.
Did people want to talk to you about the details of that?
They did, but I didn't want to talk about it. Nobody thought I was pleased about it, but I was not wanting to confide. I had grown up children. I had a life that was, we'd been through a hell of a lot together and it felt like a really catastrophic way to end it. So dealing with that kind of catastrophe was what I went back to Jordan with, thinking this is a fabulous project. I know how to make it happen. I'd quoted them on the job, a modest kind of Australian amount of money, and went back to Jordan and I started working on the book.
And once you begin working on the book and having these lengthier conversations with Prince Hassan, how did you address him? Like, was it a formal kind of conversation you had to have?
It was formal enough in that he would come to a special place where we would talk, which was a pavilion where we worked. And we were the other Australian and I, the woman that I'd been at school with, playing hockey with, were in this little pavilion.
Wouldn't have seen that at the Colac Battlers, that this is where you'd end up in Prince Hassan's sitting room.
She was fabulous. She was a real Aussie working in the Middle East. There are quite a few of these incredible creatures.
So you and her and the prince would be there discussing.
The prince would come when he could fit in an interview. That became the problem. He was very much in demand. He was, because the war was on and people wanted to talk to him. All kinds of people would come through Amman wanting an appointment with Prince Hassan and he would be invited to go and talk here, there and everywhere. So our interview sessions tended to be cancelled or we'd get maybe twice a week. Maybe we'd have an hour and then suddenly he'd be called away. It became quite frustrating, but the interviews became more and more interesting to me, and I could see the shape of the book happening. I mean, it was a very westernised environment in a way, and they were immensely friendly and pleased to have me, I think. And we got on very well, and they were very funny. They were amusing people. We had lots of laughs, and they were by this stage quite comfortable with me, and I was with them.
This was a new experience for you, though, Hilary, having as your boss a member of a royal family, a prince. Did that make things odd in any way, or were you Australian enough just for it not to even really feature?
Look, there are courtesies involved, obviously, and you stand when the prince comes into the room. There are those kinds of things. And he is almost invariably accompanied by someone carrying things, carrying his papers or carrying his files or carrying his what he fancies to drink in the way of coffee or tea or whatever.
Could you tell people what you were doing there?
No, that was what was the most irritating thing of the whole exercise. This hockey-playing person, friend of mine, kept saying, "You cannot talk about this."
So why not?
I don't know why not. I don't know why not. It was ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous. There was a kind of paranoid air about the whole project. And she would answer for me if she was with me, which she was quite a lot because she was the one who was transcribing the tapes. People would ask her in my presence, "What are you doing?" or "Why is she in Oman?" or ask me directly. And I was told to say, "We're doing a special project for Prince Hassan." So I was being told to fudge all the time.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
So, Hilary, you were travelling between the Prince's Royal Compound in Amman in Jordan and your home in Melbourne. How did Italy come into the picture?
Once the word got out that my marriage had fallen over, I got, of course, all kinds of lovely, sympathetic phone calls from friends all over the place. And one of them was my old friend, dear friend, Carmen Khalil, who is a publishing titan in England. She's amazing. And she started Virago and then she ran Jonathan Cape and Chateau and Winderson, every damn thing. She rang me and I said I was taking the Hashemite project. And she was not very pleased about that because Sidi Hassan was quite famous on English television. So people in England knew all about him. No one in Australia did, but in England they did. And she wasn't in favour of me doing this project. She said, "Why don't you write something else? Don't do that." But I was by this stage thoroughly seduced. So I said, I told her that the marriage had collapsed and I was thinking of living somewhere else for a while. And instead of going back to Australia after a taping session with Sidi Hassan and working on the book at home and dealing with jet lag, sort of 38 hours of flying, I was thinking of maybe going to Italy where I'd been before. And she said she thought she had a friend there who might be able to help me. So that's what happened. Her friend gave me a delightful little apartment in Cortona for a delightful kind of rent that I could manage. And I would go from Amman to Cortona to write. And it was only 4 hours from Amman to Cortona via Rome. And it was fabulous. I'd hop on a train with all my bits and pieces and write where you didn't hear planes going over all the time.
Cortona is in Tuscany.
It's in Tuscany.
Is it how I would imagine a village in Tuscany to look?
It's where Frances Mayles wrote that execrable book about how wonderful Tuscany was. And she was very unpopular in Tuscany, in Cortona, I have to tell you, because so many tourists came to Cortona because of her, and they all wanted to go and see her house, but didn't really want to see anything else. And she'd apparently tried to stop a public swimming pool being used because it made too much noise into her backyard or something or other.
But this is the epitome of romantic,
absolutely,
beautiful, pastoral Italy.
A love story. And I was going to Cortona not because of a love story but because of a broken heart. So obviously I was a very different candidate and I looked miserable and I felt miserable. I didn't feel miserable in Jordan because I was working. That was what was so fabulous about having this job. It was totally engrossing. passing. And it was only when I got on the train to go back to Italy, and I wanted to get there, and I was going to write and do all the work on the book there. And it was a dear little apartment, and I loved the town, but I was lonely. I was solitary there. And in Italy, there is no good word for solitude, I discovered. There is not. It's so solo mio. It's terrible. And they see you, that you're on your own in a cafe, and they don't serve you, or they give you a terrible table. Or
Tell me a bit more about the town, Hilary. How old is it?
How old is it? Oh, gosh, Etruscan. I mean, it goes way, way back with huge walls and stones and the history written in the stones. It's amazing,
and
amazing.
Tell me the story of the patron saint of Cortona.
Oh, Santa Margherita. You're the only person who's ever asked me about Santa Margherita. She was a single mother, really. She ran away from her. He may have been her husband or may have been her lover. It's not clear. But anyway, she lost her protector. And she trekked back to her family who didn't want her with her baby in the snow, these sorts of stories, and found her way to Cortona, where the Franciscans, who just started there, their monastery, took her in, which was astonishing. She was a young woman with a young son, and she became a religious person in Cortona and started her own orders for the poor, and poor women in particular, in that part of the world. So, and the magical thing about Santa Margherita was that she is still incorruto in a tiny coffin in the church at the top of the town.
What does that mean? She's in
uncorrupted. She's a saint. Her little body is lying there in her robes, in a glass, like Snow White, in a glass coffin. And people trek up the mountain and see her. And I did that too. She was amazing, amazing.
So you were in a little apartment. What kind of view did you have from the place where you did your writing?
Right over the plains where the Tuscan armies marched, and you could hear the trains going down below and so on. It was a fabulous little apartment.
A big sky.
Wonderful. Big, big skies and big weathers. You'd see the weather rolling in across the plain and have to learn to deal with your washing, because if you didn't get it in, it would be billowing all over the town, which happened to me a couple of times.
Did it snow in winter?
Yes, it snowed in the winter. In the winter, it was, of course, horrifically lonely. It took me a while to work out there were two of everything in Cortona, so that the greengrocer, one of the greengrocers, could take their holidays. So there was always supplies. You weren't going to perish. But when the snows came, they filled up the lanes and the roads, which were tiny, and the snow ploughs would eventually release you. But you were contained by snow for many, many hours sometimes in the winter, and you had very big snow coats and boots and all of that kind of gear, which I acquired.
What did the other villagers make of you?
They thought I was really weird, a weird foreigner, not someone they wanted really to get to know. There was an old woman in the apartment near me who invited me in for a coffee one day, and I kept thinking, I must invite her back in. And she thought I was writing romances, and I actually thought I probably should have been writing romances by this stage, because I was starting to realise that the book was getting to the point where it was very hard to be the one I wanted to do.
Tell me about one friend that you made, a friendship with, an older woman called Nella. Who was she?
I met Nella. She lived at the top of a town in the most beautiful house I've ever seen in my life, with a linden tree on the courtyard and an astonishing house built into the side of the mountain. And Nella was very rich, but she was also very mean, like a lot of rich women are. And she bought all her clothes at the charity shop, and she was always telling me I was too extravagant, and she would use me to hold her car. She had an old bomb of a car. And she'd go charging across the plain to take a piece of furniture to be fixed up in a town somewhere or other. And she'd have me holding the piece of furniture and the car door shut while she... And she was very old, Nella, much older than me, but very fit, because everyone in Cortona is fit, because it's so steep. They walk up hills and down hills. So I had a great fun with Nella. And she taught me a few tricks about how to get on and off trains, which was terribly handy.
What did she teach you?
She thought I had a very submissive Australian manner. She despised Australians, basically, Nella, and made it very clear that we were of no interest whatsoever. But and she said, you don't know how to find someone to help you on the train, which is indeed true. I had very big bags going backwards and forwards to Jordan with posh clothes and computers and all of that stuff. And she showed me how I could identify young men on the station who were from good families and instruct them to come and help me with the right tone of voice. So she, I can't remember how
That's
to do it.
That's a very
now.
Useful
it was a
skill.
Very handy skill, which indeed I used. And I was helped on and off the train from then on. So I was very grateful to Nella.
How were you trying to learn Italian, Hilary, while you were
I tried very hard to learn Italian, and I went to Italian classes where you had to make up stories about your life, tell the story of your life, but mine was so awful that I didn't want to tell anyone. So I made up a fancy story about everything that was happening to me. It hadn't happened to me, and my Italian was terrible, and I would make little lists in the morning of things to so I could go shopping and so on, and I was hopeless at it. And I think it was because I was so miserable. All that was coming back to me was my bit of I had reasonable French and schoolgirl German, and they would come pouring back into my brain, and my Italian was non-existent, absolutely non-existent, until my family started arriving and my granddaughter spoke Italian, and I sort of pulled myself together and got a bit better.
Given that you're someone who's made their life in words, it must have been very disconcerting to not be able to speak in the way
Indeed.
You wanted.
Terrible. To be silenced is an awful thing. And it made me, of course, immensely sympathetic to other stranieri who were strangers in that place and no one spoke to them.
You say that you were very lonely. Had you ever lived alone before?
No, I hadn't. I was astonished to work out I'd never, ever lived alone. Yes, never.
And how were you treated as a single woman in Cortona?
In Cortona, I was just ignored. I'd have to insert myself to make something happen. I think I looked terrible. I think I looked very miserable trudging through the snow or trudging along the street with my little bag of, you know, food for that day. And I don't think the vibe that was coming off me was particularly appealing, but I made an effort. I went out to eat and I went to, there were bars, very terrific bars and terrific coffee shops and all of that sort of stuff. So I would go and then realise that I'm being ignored and not know how to insert myself with my rotten Italian. So I had another friend who was Lyndall Passerini, and she was much, much kinder to me than Nella was. Nella wasn't kind. Nella was rude to me and made me laugh a lot. But Lyndall showed me the ropes. She'd lived there for many years. She was a wonderful left-wing contessa, actually, but she never used the title. And she'd lived in Cortona for 40 years, and it was her apartment I was in.
For some women, living alone, particularly after a lifetime of looking after children and husbands, can be glorious and liberating. Why do you think it was so not that way for you?
My son, who was working in London with drug-affected kids, used to ring me up to make sure I was okay, and he said, what's wrong with you, Mum, is that you're blaming yourself for everything, which is true, I was. And he said, I'll send you a book. He sent me one called Feeling Good, which I had to read a bit of every night. I didn't, but it was very nice to get advice from your kids.
Were you surprised? Were you taken aback by how hard you found living alone?
Absolutely. Devastated, but shocked by it. It's very shocking to realise how vulnerable this. What happened to me happens to many, many women of my age, and everything stops. You think nothing will ever start again. I mean, but I was very fortunate because I had work, and I had work I was engrossed in. Friends visited me sometimes on their way through to somewhere else, and that was beaut too.
Did you confide in any of those visiting friends?
No, I didn't. Because they were from here, and they were tactless. They would arrive sometimes and say, oh, I saw your husband at the book launch or this or that. I didn't want to hear anything like that at all. I just wanted to be kind of cut off, I think. Anyway, it was a hard time. I recovered.
When you look back at it now, do you think that difficulty, that grief even, was it all about your marriage, or was it just that being alone let things come to the surface, maybe for many, many years over many different things that hadn't had the chance to?
I think lots of things come up when something big like that happens to you. And I realised that I was extremely depressed and not coping very well. And things had happened to me, of course. I mean, I was in my mid-60s, so I had many, many things happen to me. I'd had three children and a baby before my three children who was born prematurely and died after a couple of days, which had always shattered me at that time of year. It was in late April. And that surfaced again. It always surfaces, and other things that had happened to me surfaced as well. So when you're very, very alone, you face your own guilt, you face your own complicity in things that you've done, you face the good things and the loss of the good things and some of the bad things. So it was a very hard time. And I was, I think I was in a very, very fortunate position to be able to deal with all this better than I would if I'd been somewhere, if I'd been back home, maybe. I don't know.
Things were coming to a head with the Prince's book as well. What feedback were you getting from him?
The first four chapters I left behind he didn't like because they were too personal, and I found that extraordinary. He didn't want any information about his childhood at all. He didn't want mention of his mother. He had the most marvellous mother, who I felt I knew because I'd seen so many photos of her. And I knew that there would be some stories he wouldn't want told, but I wasn't prepared for him to say, I've forgotten the word he used to dismiss it, but it was too soft for him. He didn't want it. He was much more interested in doing a book about politics, about policy, about being Crown Prince, about institution building, and that was the one we started to do.
Did you increasingly get the sense that there were other people with their fingers in the pie around this book, that maybe decisions were being made elsewhere in the family?
It took me a long time to realise that the family wanted a certain kind of book, there's no doubt. The Princess Anne's wife, who I liked enormously, would come and offer herself to be interviewed about things she wanted in the book. But the things she wanted were not the things that he wanted. And similarly, the daughter did the same thing, Princess Badia, but Princess Badia wanted him to say more about women, and I did too. So that was we were on the same page there. But people were telling me stories. I was getting much more in tune with the family and also aware of what the complexities were. So I had a strong sense that the only kind of book we could do was the kind that he was happy to do.
What led you then to decide to withdraw from the project? What happened for you to say, I can't work on this anymore?
It sounds so pathetic now. And when I look back at all the documentation, the notes I'd made at the time and everything, I'm astonished but that I did withdraw. I finished the book. I was just alone in the place where I worked there, because most of the foreign people who worked for them had gone on holidays. It was very, very hot. It was June and the family were in London. And I wasn't entirely alone, but I was finishing the book. And I started getting phone calls from London from members of the family wanting changes made. And I made ones that seemed to me to be perfectly reasonable. And then I heard from the housekeeper, who'd been the woman who rang me originally, that Princess Anne was sitting in the garden with his daughter, looking very depressed, she said, looking very depressed, and my heart sank. I knew what was happening. I knew the garden because I'd been there myself, you know, doing some interviewing of him when he was in London, and I had the strong sense that the book was, he was being got at to simplify the book, to change some of the things in the book. He'd once said to me in one of our interviewing sessions, which had gone extremely well, he turned to me and he said, "Don't let them censor me." And I didn't ask him who they were. I didn't have the faintest idea. But this is what came back to me when I was getting these phone calls. And they were getting more and more adamant, and they were becoming instructions. I am ordering you.
Other people in the royal family, not the prince himself.
No, not the prince. This was the Princess Badia, who was ringing me. And she was a very young woman, and she said, "I'm ordering you to make these changes." And I said, "But dear, I can't make them unless your father tells me himself that he wants. It's his book and he has to instruct me himself." And she went away and I didn't hear. He didn't ever bring me and instruct me. And she rang again and said, "I am instructing you. This is what must happen. This is what must be done." They were changes to the tone of the book. They were making it much more obsequious, I think. But things about the succession change that he had wanted in a very modest kind of way, they were turning it so that it was not the book that he wanted. I felt quite sure of that. So I said, "I can't make them, my dear," and I just left it at that. I hung up and I finished the project and left it in, printed it off in the office and left it in six neat little piles. I don't know why six, but I did leave six. And I copied it all onto a USB stick, of course, and I got the office to get me a plane out, and I got a plane out. And I
thought, you just left?
I just left, and I left and I sent all the way back on the train, plane on the train. I kept thinking, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? And I got back to Cortona and I was sure I was doing the right thing, and I sent a long email explaining why. I couldn't finish it, but offering to finish it for them to get it to the point where they were happy and I would see it through the publisher in London, where I was a lot, and I'd set up a publisher there for them. I was then rung and persuasion was tried, and I still said no, no, no. I couldn't take that. I think I'd still be there, really, arguing. And because he didn't come and tell me himself why he wanted those changes, it was not possible.
Was it being spoken to
rudely
by a young woman that also
put you off? I was rather ashamed to say it was being... My Australianness rose up. I just thought, I can't cop being spoken to like that. It was something to do with a monarchy, I don't know.
Did you ever hear from Prince Hassan himself after you left?
I got I've still got it, of course, a wonderful big envelope with a red seal, arrived in the mail in Cortona, big red seal, with a lovely letter from him saying that he'd valued it and that it made him think very hard about his work and good things like that. And I was very pleased about that. And I didn't, of course, hear from anyone else ever again.
Has he gone on to publish a version of the book that you were working on?
I kept checking the publisher's website and hoping that it would pop up, and there it would be, probably with photos added, and because we were going to have photos, so lovely photos to include, and with the bits cut out that they wanted to cut out, but it never appeared. So I suspect it was a form of therapy for Prince Hassan, and it was a form of therapy for me too, I think. I mean, it was a very, that's only just occurred to me this moment, but it was a project that I think he enjoyed doing, and I certainly felt fabulous at doing. I enjoyed it very much, and they gave me a wonderful time, and there is no book. So I had a failed marriage and a failed book, and I came back to Australia where it was quite a hard thing to deal with those two things, but that's all right.
Well, you came back to Australia with this realisation that living alone maybe wasn't the right thing to do for Hilary McPhee. No. So who lives with you now? Who's in your house?
When I came back to Australia, I decided that musicians might be the answer, because various people advised me to get writers to live in the house, which I thought, I'd had a writer living in the house, a husband writer, and, you know, two writers is hopeless, so not a writer. And it was a particular kind of house with rather thick walls and wooden floors and so on. So a young musician, a son of a friend of mine in London, Nishad, came to me one day and said, "This house is perfect for musicians." He went upstairs and he checked it all out, and I suddenly thought, yes, of course. I thought, I'll get some musicians. And I managed to find a cellist and a violinist who came to live in the house. And it was wonderful.
So you could hear them practicing?
I'd hear
and
them
playing.
Practicing, and they would, yes, they'd go off and they formed a quartet, and I got very involved in all their lovely projects as well. But it was the right advice, musicians. They're no longer there. They were there for four lovely years, and then I now have a trumpeter and a tuba player, which is rather amazing. But they're very interesting too. You know, musicians are extraordinary people.
I'm very glad you found your musicians. Hilary, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks, Sarah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
My guest on Conversations today was Hilary McPhee, and Hilary's book is called Other People's Houses. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.